Well, boys, looks like you started the fun without me.
You're all sick. Every last one of you.
We're going to need a bigger gun.
What's the matter? You scared of things that go boom, boom, boom?
Give me one goddamn reason why I shouldn't blow your goddamn brains all over that goddamn wall.
The time has finally come to do this. My name is Eric 13. I'm here with Michael Kester. I have been, here's a thing I knew and a thing that I did not know.
You mean the two films that, today?
Yeah. I knew that I've been waiting something like 2 years to do this episode, but it was a surprise to me that I've also been waiting like 17 years to do this episode. Right. I wasn't aware that that was going to happen.
Right.
But what the fuck? I guess it did. I didn't even realize it was 17 years until I had to do that math in my head. That's a long fucking time.
Yeah.
Holy Christ. We got two movies today.
Two films by two directors that the two hosts of this show really like. We are doing Rob Zombie's new film 31, which you can view now. These are movies you can view right now.
Today.
One not theatrically yet, but you can get that one on VOD, and then you can go out to the theater and see The Woods. But it won't be called The Woods because now it's actually called Blair Witch, which is an Adam Wingard movie.
It is. It is. We got corrected last time by a listener named Adam Wingard, who said his name is pronounced Adam Wingard. So I hope I'm doing that right. Otherwise, we might get a mean tweet or something. So this is about the most spoilable show by everyone's definition of spoiler.
Definitely. Right.
This isn't, oh, that movie came out 6 months ago. We can all spoil it now, right? Now, this is, I mean, these things are barely even out.
Right.
We were worried the show wouldn't even, our math would be wrong on this.
Well, to put it in perspective, when we planned this show, when we put this show on the schedule, we assumed we would be seeing both of these films in the theater. One, mistake. And two, that one of these films was not a Blair Witch movie. Those were the two things that we had wrong. And to be fair, I did see, you did see, we managed to, we slipped through the cracks on seeing 31 in the theater.
Yeah, right. It was in the theater.
Through it. It was more expensive for you to slip through it than it was for me.
Right. Much more expensive. Can I get this out of the way at the top of the thing? I'm an executive producer on 31.
Right.
I did that. So that can be over now.
Yeah.
But even just going to Sundance was much more expensive than you going down the fucking street.
Right. I just went over to the Draft House
or wherever
and ordered myself some bottomless popcorn.
Right. If people want to know how fancy executive producing is, I definitely slept in my car one of those afternoons at Sundance. So that was, I wanted to go again this year. I can't afford Sundance this year. That's nuts. That's just nuts. Anyways, we're going to spoil the things. And 24 minutes in, we're going to talk about Blair Witch. Thank fuck they didn't call it The Blair Witch.
Right.
Or it would have screwed up my whole don't do movies that are already named something we've already done thing. That would have been awful.
Right.
That would have been a crisis of double feature proportions.
Although you know that it's the original film is called The Blair Witch Project. You're familiar with that as well.
Oh.
Yeah.
I forgot about that.
Right.
I didn't. Yeah. I don't even know what we're doing right now. These are the two people you want to hear talk about these brand new films. And also, I think there is a happenstance, coincidental, extra double feature tie-in. So we'll talk about that too. But this goddamn 31.
Yeah.
I want to say, one, it's a gift to the show because it starts with the new Franz Kafka quote. So we don't have to talk about the same goddamn Franz Kafka thing.
Right.
But the first sign of the beginning of understanding is the wish to die, which is really just right in my heart. Right. That is a 2016 theme for a 2016 movie. But this is, and I ran into this a little bit with Director's Cut. You know, you get involved so early and then you get scared. Like, will the movie be good? Do I even know what the fuck this is? Mm-hmm. Is it going to be, you know, an ICP movie? And the opening of this was all I needed. I was just so fucking excited. The grisly sort of black and white opening. And I know you want to talk about Doomhead.
Yeah.
And it just,
oh my God.
It starts so fucking Rob Zombie because, you know, music and 70s. And
I don't feel like it does start Rob Zombie.
Oh, really?
Well, kind of. We'll talk about that. That's going to be a thing. But no, you're right. It is, it does start Rob Zombie. It does. You're completely right.
But when we get to the actual, you know, the grainy black and white, high contrast, door swings open.
Mm-hmm.
And this is actually something that felt, of all the stuff we'll talk about that's very Rob Zombie, this is something I don't think we've really seen in one of his movies.
I disagree because it reminded me, and this is weird, a lot of the opening to Super Beasto.
Well, you can't, just Super Beasto.
Why? Yeah. You remember that where the guy comes out from the curtain and gives the monologue?
Yeah,
but yeah, that's exactly what this, no, I'm kidding. But it did remind me of that.
But that's a cartoon.
That's true. Sure.
Yeah. Yeah. You're going to be right a couple times because this is the first cartoon character we're introduced to in this movie.
Right.
Of what will become a long series of even a Malcolm McDowell cartoon character.
Mm-hmm.
And the way he walks into this shot, snaps right into the light and talks. I mean, like you're saying with Super Beasto, almost directly to the audience.
Mm-hmm.
They put a character in front of him.
Right.
They couldn't pick a better arts to put in front of him, by the way. That is, when that happened, when the camera flipped around and I saw him, I fucking lost my mind. And I was the only one. No one else thought that was the most hilarious thing in the planet. But if you could have picked just a token person to get chopped up in the beginning, it would have been that or Ted Raimi.
Right.
If the camera had spun around and revealed Ted Raimi, I think it had the same effect. But to come right up in your face like that and have this connection of, you know, the eyes directly into the camera and the fact he doesn't blink and this kind of intensity. And he has to give this, so it's a really long take. And because they shoot it so fucking sharp and so, you know, the eye shine is really prevalent, you can't not be engaged with this character.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? There's nothing, it's a super fucking close up of his face. It is 100 stories big. And it's an incredibly intimidating introduction to this character. You really feel like you're in the chair snapped into this guy's eye locked with him.
Uh-huh.
And then he gives this monologue, which is also, I'm going to be totally honest, this is the most impressive scene of the movie to me.
No, I agree.
It's just so crazy good. You can't hide behind anything when you do that because everything is so right there. And it's all his performance. You see every little eye twitch, every little bit of, you know, the makeup, the blood on the teeth. When he chooses to give a little gaspy kind of half laugh to himself or makes the decision to go from like a monotonous, normal sounding tone to like an aggressive snap.
Mm-hmm.
And has to be able to do that without the audience seeing the actor kind of warm up to, I know this is the part where I'm going to snap.
Mm-hmm.
It has to really look fresh and to not cut away from it for so long just impresses the fuck out of me and builds this character who becomes, for anything else in the movie, a Rob Zombie character I will not forget.
The thing about Doomhead and the thing about opening the film with Doomhead, from a musical standpoint, that would be like if Rob Zombie opened the show with Dracula. You do that, and then everybody goes, well, shit.
everybody but me.
And that's my point, right? Is that the audience, 31 is very much kind of a Rob Zombie's greatest hits of a film.
Mm-hmm.
That said, I don't think for a second that 31 was ever geared towards not Rob Zombie fans.
Or even towards anyone but Rob Zombie.
Right.
Maybe.
I feel like the audience is at its most unified in that opening scene. And then I think that it's a really brave call for the film to depart entirely from Doomhead for an hour.
Yeah, right.
Until they bring him back. And it's funny, because when you get back to Richard Brake later on, he comes into the movie like it's a fucking cameo. Like, Yeah, it's somebody you should know. And the only reason you have any idea, if you're, you know, I know him because he was the ambulance driver in Halloween 2, duh. But the average person knows him as Doomhead from the beginning of the movie.
Right, right. It does feel like he's coming from some prequel, some film from somewhere. Right.
Like you already knew,
oh man, Doomhead's going to be in this movie? Yeah, Doomhead, who was invented in the beginning of this movie.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I feel like every time Richard Brake is on screen, the film takes on this life of its own.
Yeah.
But to go back to the idea of this being a Rob Zombie greatest hits, when Doomhead's not on the screen, it's basically a greatest hits record of what Rob Zombie does best all the time.
Mm.
All these ideas from his other films, even from his music videos or from his live show, it is another Rob Zombie addition to his filmography. And even I don't know if you knew this. When I saw 31, there was a Rob Zombie Q&A afterward.
You and your draft house.
But one of the things is apparently this movie, it's not shocking that it comes off feeling like something Rob Zombie does so well, because this movie came out of essentially a place of frustration where Rob Zombie was working on, quote, a not horror project, Broad Street Bullies, and then became frustrated and said to his friend or his producer, maybe, you know, I can come up with a horror movie right off the bat and it will be amazing.
Yeah.
I need help if it's not a horror movie.
Yeah.
And he goes, I mean, if this were a movie about, I don't know, a bunch of fucking killer clowns in the 70s that kill people on Halloween. And that's where this movie came from. It was bred from the frustration of being unable to make this movie. Right.
Yeah.
So I think it makes so much sense when you're watching 31 that it feels really familiar.
Yeah.
I mean, you're right. Once you get out of the Doomhead monologue and into the crew of people on the fuzzy road, listening to Joe Walsh, immediately you go, this is a Rob Zombie movie. This is possibly the most Rob Zombie movie ever made.
It feels like a purging of his mind.
Exactly. Yeah.
That he's just, let me get some Rob Zombie out.
Exactly. Exactly.
But I don't even know if that's so much by choice of grinding on the project so much as, you know, we've seen this through his whole career, and this happens to everybody, but I just think it's been especially visible because we pay attention. But, you know, Tyrannosaurus Rex, and talking about Bullies, talking about the Groucho Marx movie, talking about all these different things, and they kind of, this is the classic Rob Zombie movie story, is there's other people who are not playing as nicely. And, you know, it's always a push and pull with his movies. And we've talked about this constantly. And I think one of the things that makes 31 feel this way is it is just so streamlined. This is what you're looking at when you don't have producers of a longstanding Halloween franchise, you know, picking battles, and you don't have somebody you've been, you know, waiting on to debate casting or have some kind of, I don't know, development process, right?
Sure.
Some sort of development is stalling process. So for him to go, well, what if I did this and this? Basically, what if I did The Most Dangerous Game on Halloween?
Sure.
And really do the kind of 70s take on that, that is a lot more, it just seems like a spilling out of his mind.
Mm-hmm.
Every single character in this movie feels like a, not even the other Rob Zombie movies so much as almost an impression of Rob Zombie himself.
Yeah.
You know, if we were to go, oh, that Rob Zombie thing, each character kind of represents that Rob Zombie thing.
Yeah, definitely.
In all these different directions where there's no attempt at large elaborate backstory.
Right.
You know the characters as soon as you get in that van.
I would argue that the one character where I look at it and don't see the Rob Zombie thing, just to support your claim, is, I can't, oh man, I'm at a loss for his name. Psycho Head?
Oh, yeah.
Right? Is it Psycho Head? No. No. Not the brothers.
No, you're thinking of Sickhead.
Sickhead. Sickhead is the only place in this film where I go, I don't see Rob Zombie here.
That is a really funny thing, because I think Yeah, that's, you know, there's the werewolf women of the SS thing.
Right, yeah.
That I know he's got rolling around in his head.
But the Nazis in Super Visto. So we've seen Nazis, yeah. But I've never seen Rob Zombie toy with Mexican Nazis.
Well, that was, yeah, that's absolutely true. Rob Zombie has not toyed with Mexican Nazis. I love this show. I just, I cannot get enough of this. Pancho Muller knew the actor who played him, knew Spanish.
Mm-hmm.
And
sure.
I think they were just, well, obviously he knows Spanish. Look at him in this movie.
Right.
I mean, he's just
right.
going fucking nutty with it. But I think if I have this right, I know it wasn't planned
right.
for him
no,
to
that's
speak
how it feels.
Any Spanish.
Totally how it feels.
But I think he was doing it just to kind of fuck around with Sherry. And then Zombie decided, yeah, just that'll be weird. Just do that.
Right.
So
and that's kind of how it feels.
Yeah. So just to add another level of being this little bomb of crazy. I mean, from the beginning of the conception of that character, there was Nazi elements to it. It was going to be a really short guy, if not, I think basically the character came out exactly like it was designed, except there's also a lot of Spanish.
Right, totally.
So, you know, it was designed to be one of the nuttiest characters. And I think that's, aside from the dialogue in the van, that's the thing that happens immediately after Doomhead to snap you in a spot that goes, you're about to see unadulterated camp.
Mm-hmm.
This is going to be a midnight fest of a movie.
Yeah.
And if you can't deal with, you know, tiny Nazi
right.
Spanish speaking, like
the movie is definitely, it's a series of almost vignettes, but icons. It goes, you can draw clear lines as the film moves along. You can almost, you know, I've seen 31 now twice.
Mm.
And I feel like I can go to 31 and again, to just keep harping on this greatest hits element.
Uh-huh.
I feel like I can go to 31 and go, I don't want to listen to tracks 1, 2, or 3. I just want to hear 4 and 7.
Right. You could literally
so
skip
you just,
between
you
them.
Just go into the movie, you watch the schizo head, psycho head scene, you skip to doom head, and then you play the rest of the tracks because you know, you're not going to take the CD out at that point.
Yeah. Right. Right. I don't like your CD metaphor for obvious reasons in this here digital age in which we live in, but
I'm sorry.
I think that's exactly to it. Except some people might be missing if you jump ahead. You
right.
might go, well, I guess they didn't make it this far. And it is almost round for round. Okay, we've got a new challenge and who's going to go missing? Because it is this line of camp and you know that from the beginning, that could become something to really lay back and just kind of let happen to you. But the thing that kept me really kind of intrigued about it was, unlike a lot of our, you know, Final Girl movies,
mm-hmm.
the premise of this game is very specific in that everybody could live or no one could live.
Mm-hmm.
4 characters could live, 2 characters, you know, you have no idea. And you probably know the numbers are going to get pretty thin, if not obliterated. But what that does to me the whole way through the movie until the very last moment is even when it's down to the end, there's fucking spoilers in this, not that anyone cares. But when it's down to Sherry, big fucking spoiler that it would be Sherry.
Mm-hmm.
Turns out Sherry's the first one to go. Huh? Who saw that? Who saw that coming?
The Screen Actors Guild saw it coming.
Could you? That would be the funniest thing, actually. Forget Ted Raimi if you turn around from Doomhead and it's Sherry and you're like, wow, I really didn't see that happening, huh? In my head, I was just thinking, I wonder if the Groucho Marx movie is stalled because they don't want Sherry to play Groucho Marx. I wonder if that's what the hangup is there. Of course, I love her in this, like in all these other movies. But when we get down to it, I'm going, this doesn't need to have the one survivor that gets away. Even when it's down to the last 2 characters.
Sure, right.
They could both disappear hours before 31 is over,
mm-hmm.
or they could make it out. And I'm actually kind of going, well, what are they going to do with this?
Well, I think when you get to the end of the movie, the most tricky part for me is that I'm rooting for Doomhead.
Well, I know.
Richard Brake as Doomhead is such a charismatic force in this movie that I go, I don't want to see him fail for the first time. I didn't sign up to watch Doomhead fail.
Right.
And that to me was kind of the moment where I realized that with 31, more than any other individual aspect of 31, I feel like what Rob Zombie created with 31 is the most transcendent of the villains in any of his movies. I mean, Captain Spaulding will probably always be the most iconic just because he's got colorful makeup and Sid Haig, you know, for me, the most transcendent Rob Zombie villain up until 31 was Otis Driftwood. Always Bill Moseley in Devil's Reject.
It's funny that those hung on so long. And then of course we get to Halloween and Michael Myers, very iconic. Mm-hmm. One of, as we've often talked about, the most iconic individuals for a slasher.
Yeah.
They're all built around icons, but you think, you know, Michael Myers had the most solid foundation of who he was. It's just such a perfect choice for Rob Zombie. But you and I were talking off the air not too long ago about the lack of colorful villains in movies. Mm-hmm. And I think we were talking about certain specific genres or whatever, but you don't have to look far to find protagonists that are built in this mold to try and make them memorable and get them on the side of the audience. But even in the horror movies, the ones we've applauded over the last couple of years, it's not the one psycho killer. It's the weird premise, the weird invitation, the weird thing that's in the fucking woods. It's not this specific individual. Mm-hmm. And not only has Rob Zombie always been pretty good about fleshing out some good villains.
Possibly the best.
To build this movie around, he knows he's got something here.
Yeah.
Well, look at the setup for the movie. I mean, when Doomhead is in the scene, the objective is point the camera at Doomhead to make the movie.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Definitely.
It goes back to what you were saying earlier, but you know, we spend time, we're straight on Doomhead. And of course, I don't want to short sell. I mean, I was talking about all the cinematography around that scene to lock you in.
Yeah.
So that is important. But you can tell that, all right, so our focus in this particular scene is Doomhead. Then we drift around, we're hanging out in the van, we're going for, you know, what different parts are interesting. We're going for feeling like we're in a seat or looking at the nudity. We're getting all of these different, you know, when we're in this kind of ceremony room, looking up at these giant epic cathedral things that Rob Zombie's really started loving in his last couple of movies.
Mm-hmm.
And we're looking at set pieces and just how dirty everything is. Just all the grit and the practical effects and blood spraying and actors really rolling around in sweat and just locations. Everything is wet and humid and the fucking food. It's all over the place trying to capture this kind of schizophrenic fun, this dirt and this grime and this stuff that feels really, you know, the life of it. The stuff that feels, to keep your music comparison, very mosh pit, very, you could taste the iron of the blood in your mouth. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the things I love about Rob Zombie movies is that it feels like you are pulling up dirt in your hands. None of it feels like you're sitting on a command deck somewhere watching this thing happen in front of you. It feels like you're going to need to take a shower after the movie because you're going to be covered in grease and dirt and some straw in your hair and just this catastrophe until Doomhead shows up again. And then you can tell everybody kind of perks up and goes, oh yeah, Doomhead's back. Put the camera over there.
Right.
It becomes like you're shooting a live performance. Mm-hmm. You're just going, oh, the appearance of Doomhead. We're
film Justin Timberlake, always on Timberlake.
Right. It feels like a live news broadcast to me. That you're just
camera
going, oh,
on
that's
Timberlake.
Over there. Just beautiful. It's what I love about Rob Zombie movies. That grittiness was the thing that I was talking about, tying that to Blair Witch, which, you know, we covered the Blair Witch Project, as you reminded me, the word fucking project is in there. And among numerous things that are very iconic about that is simply how it's filmed and the fact you kind of feel like you're in the woods with these people. You feel like you're living out their stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Again, you feel like you have earth in your hands.
Mm-hmm.
there's no clean path around this. You're going to trip on things and you're going to fucking knock into stuff and you're going to get dirty. And that experience is the kind that leaves you trying to catch your breath, at trying to recover
right
after a movie. You know, you can't really walk away from that and just forget about it. It's over. Everything is fine. But Blair Witch was, as we talked about in the open, a secret.
Yeah.
For, I don't know if you realize this, 4 years this was in development and being worked on.
I did not know it was that long.
Can you fucking believe that? 4 years. So here's another fun little interesting thing about Twitter. If you go back on Twitter, and I guess this is a bloody disgusting thing, the only people who knew about this, it was like one dude at Bloody Disgusting wrote an article, I want to say years ago, and there was a bunch of tweets about the stupid article Bloody Disgusting ran where they were trying to make the woods into some Blair Witch project because it was a slow news day. And then everybody just like got off it. They were just, no, that's stupid. And then just, it stopped. It was like somebody figured it out and just nobody paid attention because they didn't believe it.
And that's a damn shame when it turned out to be the Blair Witch movie, because that person did not get any credit. And
I could not feel
any vindication at all.
That article should screen like at the front of the credits. Like, oh, one person figured it out. Even the crew, though, didn't know what movie they were making.
Sure.
I mean, they kept this so under wraps to the point of there even being a trailer for The Woods.
Uh-huh.
People saw a trailer for this movie and didn't even know what the fucking movie is. And it's not only a cool thing that, all right, we think we're doing The Woods. It's Adam's new movie. It looks really fucking scary and creepy. And then we find out it's Blair Witch moments before it fucking comes out.
Right.
That just blows my goddamn mind more than any horror news that's happened in the entirety of our podcast. But also it's kind of a tribute to the marketing of the first movie.
Oh, yeah.
Remember we talked so much about, you know, the actors go missing and is it real or fake and all this cannibal Holocaust-y kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And for them to come back with this movie 2 decades later, after Blair Witch has been so off the radar, and have another kind of stunt like this that sticks out in my head. Now this franchise has 2 gargantuan, what a insane thing they did when this movie came out, kind of marketing things to it. So it's interesting that we talked about the Blair Witch Project kind of recently in the last couple of years, because we were looking at it from a point that, you know, here we are in modern society and we're looking back on the quaintness of
right
using this old recording technology. And I don't know if you had thought about this before it happened, but it really hit me when they bust out all the gear and I go, oh yeah, because this is today. So the whole, it's basically the thought experiment of, well, what if Blair Witch took place today instead of way back then?
Yeah.
I didn't really think about that.
Right. I think one of the, honestly, if I could pick a film, I know we're not supposed to do this. I'm bending the rules.
Do it.
If I could pick a film that I would say, if people were to come to me and go, so the new Blair Witch, is it good? I would say completely unequivocally that it's absolutely fucking phenomenal and you must see it in theaters. The problem is the follow-up question is always, well, actually it's one of 2 questions. One is, but didn't the first Blair Witch kind of suck? To which I then just walk away from that person. I don't right. have, there's no more conversation
right,
there.
Right.
The following question that I maybe met with is, but is it better than the original? And the answer has to be a hard no. It can't be better than the original movie.
It's Blair Witch. It's
right.
the movie we still go back to for found footage.
Right. It can't. And that's the thing that I think it's really important.
This isn't The Exorcist 3. We can't just.
It's when you're looking at a movie that is, you know, blurring the line between sequel and reboot of the Blair Witch. The most important thing to think about when you're thinking about the original film is that it worked because of the time it came out.
Mm-hmm.
Because you didn't have drones and helmet cams and it felt way more visceral.
Yeah.
But that said, this movie could not succeed to the level it succeeds without the original film.
Yeah.
Which is where I will definitely go. That's why I'm going to bat for this movie as a sequel and not a reboot. I feel like without film, you're missing this movie. You don't get it.
Yeah. Well, the other thing is that this manages to be so, let me say a couple things about that. One is that the funny thing about the response to this movie is the day before this movie came out, people had mixed feelings about if the original Blair Witch was good. And the day after this movie came out, everyone, including critics, mm-hmm. surrounded the original Blair Witch as this movie we all agreed was perfect.
Right.
And then decried the new movie instead. So 20 years from now, people will go, yeah, but is it as good a sequel
right.
as Blair Witch right. was? But also for this movie to top the scariness
oh my God.
Of the original,
definitely.
Given that that premise has already, it's already been there. The first person camera thing has already been capitalized on over and over. And to follow in the footsteps of that, you are basically handicapped by the first movie.
Mm-hmm.
You have to work so much fucking harder past the original idea
right.
to just every little piece of this. How do we make it scarier than the first when the first already happened?
Well, I think when you look at what this movie is, when you kind of break it down, Wingard?
I believe Wingard.
I'm not saying it.
Wingard.
Not saying it.
It's a hyphen.
Don't care.
You say Wingard and I'll throw a frisbee at your head in the middle.
Cool.
And
sounds good. The individual who directed this really did is he took each aspect of the original film and instead of going, I need to beat this, he just looked at it and goes, how do we amplify this to a contemporary level? How do we take every individual thing that made the first film great and go, instead of altering it, instead of trying to redirect it, it's just amplify. Literally, I mean, it is fucking loud.
Yeah.
But it is amplified, you know, things like technology, things like more people in the woods, things mm-hmm. like more of the witch dolls, things like longer time spent in the house, a little more backstory, a little more storm.
Which should be the formula for failing.
Agreed.
That's the thing we
totally.
Always decry is you yeah. can't just have more aliens.
And here's where I think he manages to toe the line. Which is the one thing I'm going through this movie. And I mean, every fucking 30 seconds that go by, I become tenser and tenser for two reasons.
I know.
One, because the movie is fucking scary. And as the movie goes on, it just gets more scary and more tense and more in a tiny little tube and you want to vomit.
Yeah.
But the other thing is I'm sitting there going, oh my God, don't show the witch. Oh my God, don't show the witch.
Yeah. Yeah.
But the other part of me is, of course, going, I need to see this fucking witch. I need to see it.
Right.
And so I think that the great success of the film comes from exactly from showing the exact perfect amount of witch. It's enough witch that you can walk out and sketch the witch, but not enough witch that your sketch and your friend's sketch is the same witch.
Yeah, totally. I'm not sure I could sketch it out because the second pencil goes to paper, I would have like a PTSD thing going on.
I went and saw it with Hannah and I asked her if she was as scared by the witch as she thought she would be when, you know, they had built up to it. And she said, I didn't see the witch. I looked away when
that's
that
so
happened.
Funny.
So she did not.
So funny.
Hannah did not see the witch. She did not know the witch was ever in the film.
That is so funny. Well, talking about amplifying all of these pieces, that's the thing that makes me feel like I need to applaud this even more than the original, because the original just does the classy thing of, you know, it's such an infamous ending. You get so little, but it just sticks. and then you're left for two decades and that's all you have to operate on.
We're both just assuming that Book of Shadows is not a movie. That's what you've just officially done. You just went and Blair Witch ends and we wait 20 years for anything to happen.
Well, listen, I did make the Exorcist 3 joke. So you're somewhere right. in there, you're I have right. acknowledged that there is a second very, very strange. Actually, Book of Shadows and The Exorcist 2 have a lot in common.
Right.
I think excellent double feature or the worst double feature. I'm not sure. Someone else please try that. I'm not going to. But to bring this back and go, okay, well, we make it bigger. I don't know. Maybe show The Witch. That seems really fucking dangerous.
Oh, yeah.
But there are moments over and over. And, you know, I want to credit Simon, the writer, too, because I would have killed myself if I had his job. I'd be guessing every sentence I wrote down but Blair Witch is this golden thing. Although he did write it in a time where critics were mixed on Blair Witch because it was before this movie came out.
I mean, still, you're right. Writing it is difficult because you're sitting there going, I need to expand on a movie that is successful in its nuance. Everything I write down betrays what made the first movie great.
This is why I love, though, the fact that we did this show somewhat recently on the Blair Witch Project, because I feel like if we said some of these things now, it would look like we're trying to be clever in hindsight. But remember on that show, we talked about the day-night dichotomy. And that was one of the biggest things is, you know, you're safe during the day and then not during the night. And the first moment that I remember truly dreading, where my stomach drops out in this movie, is when the kid shows up and goes, why isn't the sun coming up? It's always nighttime. I'm going, wait, so I'm not going to get the split. I'm not going to get to go back to day. That's all I have. That's right, the only, right. I came to this movie seriously going, well, sometimes it'll be day and I'll be able to catch my breath. And it's just someone going, hey, if you remember that first movie, those moments of kind of clarity and breath that you got, you're not going to get any of those. Right. You're fucked from now on. Your last day has already passed you. And that was, man, that was where I just went, I didn't realize how high up the roller coaster had gone. And now I'm going, well, the only way to get to the bottom of this is to fucking go straight down. And as it moves in to be more narrow and to go in the house and to give you more mythology, the fact that we satisfy the urge for more mythology, and that is some of, if not the, I mean, it's the scariest part of the movie. Being in the house at the end is just so fucking scary. And I didn't, you know, if we just looked at this mythology wise, like we would a slasher franchise and go, what's an interesting part of the Blair Witch to expand on? What about that fucking weird house? Because we were only in there for like a minute, and I bet there's some weird stuff in that house.
Yeah.
Every second we're in there is a second too long, not because it's walking the tact line, but because it's just so goddamn scary. And I'm going, what, please, just not, how much house is there? We can't be in this fucking house the whole. And then we get to the moment of being in the corner, and because it's POV and it's, you really, you kind of feel like you're standing in that corner. I mean, I know what happens after that. I saw the first movie. Right. I kind of know what happens after that. And for, you know, to think about the scariest place you could be is, we don't know how that character wound up in that corner or what that meant in the first film.
Right.
And then to be the one who is yourself in the corner. God, I just can't think of a fucking scarier place to be.
And to kind of drop that rule, the realization where is, if you don't look at the witch, she won't kill you.
Yeah.
The whole audience up to this point is begging to see the witch. And then the movie but you die. And
that also very cleverly is the, hey, you might see the witch, so be afraid of that coming.
Right,
because
exactly.
That scares you more if you think you're going to see. You couldn't have had that conversation with Hannah about, you know, the thought of when you see the witch, will it be scary? Because you would have just assumed, well, we don't see the witch in Blair Witch. That's right. Not really what it is. But as soon as you go, if you see it, then this, I mean, there's your foreshadowing right there.
Yeah.
So the last 20 minutes of this is actually so scary to me that I have to admit to you that I'm almost completely blind now to what happened.
Yeah.
I am almost, I had to go to this movie alone. Mm-hmm. I tried for hours to drag people to it. But in locking this in as kind of a last minute double feature for the show, it made me go see this in theaters, which I wouldn't have done because it's just too goddamn terrifying. And it's Taking of Deborah Logan, you know?
Yeah.
I just avoid it forever because it looks fucking scary mm-hmm. as fuck. And I just can't, my love for horror does not overshadow my anxiety.
Right.
So
right.
I can't, it just isn't going to win. I'm going to have a heart attack. And that happens so rarely, probably just in these two cases. And then I go, okay, well, I got to go to the theater alone. I just have to have that experience and it's going to be rough. And I tried to sit in the back because I thought that would help me, but it's actually right by the speakers.
Uh-huh.
So that was a terrible idea. Right by the rear speakers too. So right. When scary stuff is happening behind you, it's like inside my head. And I have never had this experience seeing a movie where my eyes are locked on the screen in terror, but my brain, I really think there is something psychological in me that has kind of forced me to just, it's like being abused as a child or something. No, it's seriously just, no, that was trauma. We're going to just walk that straight out.
Blair Witch is hands down the scariest movie I've ever seen in a theater. I mean, I need to see it on the small screen to know if it lives up to being as scary. I can't imagine it wouldn't. That's the best thing about found footage is that when you watch it on a small screen, it's still effective.
The smaller it gets, the worse it is.
Exactly.
Imagine watching this on YouTube, like they look at the YouTube video.
Yeah.
It just seems like you're finding something you're not supposed to see.
Exactly. Right. Which actually that was all the Drafthouse pre-show was just those YouTube videos of found footage events. Of different creepy shit. I wanted to puke by the time the movie was over. I just had to sit there and for the first time ever in my life, except maybe Cloverfield, I had to sit there and go, okay, that wasn't real. That wasn't real. That's not reality. That's not the world I live in.
Mm-hmm.
I may never go camping, but...
Yeah. It's so interesting to compare this to Cloverfield because I thought about that too. And I decided not to even mention it on the show. And I'm going to live now change my mind and it's going to be a mistake. But because Blair Witch so deserves its own world of credit, especially from people who've made horror films, but not really, you know, the scariest horror films.
Right.
Horror films that we kind of watch and study and have a fun time with. And except some of the VHS stuff, man, that scared the fuck out of me.
Oh, yeah.
But again, for some of the same reason, it's right there in your face, your reality. And when you consider Cloverfield, there's another movie where you had a trailer before a title, where it was shrouded in secrecy, where, you know, it makes distinct choices that this doesn't. You see a full monster in Cloverfield. You get a moment of payoff. And in Blair Witch, they have, I mean, it's such a specific amount of monster that you kind of get, of horror vision monster you get. And I'm honestly just really curious about how, you know, if you have a piece like this, the greatest example, let's leave this up for debate for the people who aren't exactly where we are, but I agree with you totally. This is the scariest fucking thing that's ever happened. But let's just say one of the scariest movies ever.
Sure.
How they do that is like a Fountain of Youth type treasure to me. You know, there is a secret in the making of this film that tells you how to craft the scariest fucking thing that's ever happened. And so I look at things like Cloverfield. I look at the other, you know, we've recently actually become aware that found footage is way scarier than we ever think it's going to be.
Mm-hmm.
And trying to figure out how this movie comes in the footsteps of one of the landmark instances of found footage terror, but comes after Paranormal Activity, comes after, I mean, you know, we could spend 49 minutes naming other found footage movies. I just wouldn't know until I had the opportunity to watch it 100 times on the small screen.
Right.
And really just, I mean, we could dissect the fuck out of this. And I hope people do. I hope this is just something that continues to have a steady stream of people watching it and picking it apart. And I'm just terrified of seeing it again. We have a goddamn website. It's doublefeature.fm. And email address is doublefeatureshow@icloud.com for your longer form messages. I really wanted to stress this time, because we're doing movies that are so new and we don't do that very often. The spoilers were pretty low on this episode, I think. They're event movies. You're going to fucking love them anyways. Go see these. I would consider it a personal favor to me if you go see 31. You can get that on iTunes. You can watch it at home. You can get it on a lot of different platforms. It's on VOD. It will have a limited theatrical release in October as well. Fucking go see it both places. First thing I did when I got home exhausted from seeing Blair Witch is pre-ordered that fucker. And you can probably do that in all the same places, iTunes and, I don't know, Amazon or wherever you do this. But it's really, I mean, if you dug the thing, you're going to buy it anyways. The pre-orders really do help. And I think, you know, we should reward movies like these that are just fucking great, and Blair Witch being so goddamn scary, and just tell the market you want to see more things like this.
Oh yeah.
It's worth owning them. You're going to fucking scare your friends with them later. Anyways, just go do it. Also, if you want to get a hold of us on Twitter, better place to do that probably. I'm at _ERICX13.
I am at PLINGMIE. Spell my name. Just spell my fucking name.
MI Wingard.
Fahrenheit. Point
yeah,
taken.
So yeah, that's right. That's right.
Point taken.
If you want to send me a screenshot of my name in the credits, I'm not above that. Go ahead and do that. The DRM in my iTunes wouldn't allow me to. Don't think I didn't try. We have some executive producers who are really the ones I should be name checking. And that's David B. Anderson. It's Greg Winner, Aaron Shore, Kimberly Yance, Debbie Sterin, Meta Somerville, David Koch, and Lexi Love. We buzz by their names every time, but thanks for making this show. And
yeah, and thanks for giving me at least a tiny bit of vindication, because if it weren't for you, I wouldn't be able to get Eric to go to the theater at least.
I know. Isn't it amazing? It's true. It happened. And you know, if you keep traumatizing me like this every time you get me to go to a theater.
Next week, we have a perfect example of a time I couldn't get you to go to a theater, because we're covering All About Eve, which you weren't born yet to see it at the theater. So you get a pass on that. But then we're covering The Neon Demon, which I believe I told you to see in the theater 25 times.
You did. It's funny. That's probably the most you've ever tried to get me to text me at 3 a.m. and just, are you watching The Neon Demon? Go to the theater and watch The Neon Demon.
So you all go watch The Neon Demon and All About Eve and more fucking film.
Bye.
This program is a proud member of the Battleship Pretension Fleet.